Hello everyone, I'm Dave Miller, and today we're going to talk about some work I did last summer on the Niagara systems that I have. Basically, it's called Sun Logical Domains, it's Sun's virtualization technology. But I was going to learn that in many, if not all aspects, Niagara is pretty much virtualized, even when you're using the whole system as a control node or just a standalone system, and we'll get into that later. So. Here's the rough outline where I talk about the background, what this stuff is, kind of an overview for a little bit of details. We talk about the user land simulator I wrote to start to bootstrap this implementation, get things going quickly. Then I'll talk about exactly what we put into the Linux kernel to support pure guest node support for this stuff. And then stuff I want to do next and what was really difficult. Okay, so as I alluded to, Niagara is virtualized all the time. Even the most mundane CPU operations like loading TLB entries and things of this nature go through the hypervisor. And the V in Sun4V, which is the product line for all those virtualized Sun machines, is stands for virtualization. The whole idea is that you don't expose the physical details of the system, generic virtualization concepts. The PCI controllers behind the hypervisor as well. If you want to access devices, you got to go through the hypervisor to do a PCI config access. You got to go through it to do load ILMU entries, etc., etc. So the point is that even when I first did a Linux port to pure Niagara before this LDOM stuff even existed, I had to go through the hypervisor for all this stuff. So the beauty of it is that all the infrastructure I needed to support LDOMs was largely implemented already. So if you don't know how Spark works with traps, what happens is there's a trap table, and there are slots, and there's about 8 instructions per slot, and each trap type has a vector. It offsets into the table by 8 instructions, and then it just branches there and starts executing the code at that location. Certain timing critical routines, such as TLB mishandling, have multiple slots dedicated to them, so you vector to the first one, the next 3 are not used for anything else. The first half of the trap table is used for hardware exceptions, FPU, disable, TLB misses, interrupts, things of that nature. And then the second half is used for software stuff, so you could just say trap this certain number and that vectors into the table from user space or the kernel anywhere. And this is how we implement system calls. If we wanted to specialize a certain system call, like get time of day or whatever, and we didn't want to use VDSOs for whatever reason, which is the standard way to optimize that, we could just allocate a trap vector in the software half of the trap table for that. But they extended the trap table even further, is that if you used what would be the end of the trap table vector index for software traps, from then on, they map to hypervisor traps, which maps into the hypervisor. The hypervisor has its own little trap table. There's a separate register that holds the base of the trap table for the hypervisor. So when you do a hyper trap, it goes directly into the hypervisor. And another thing to know is that several exception types, such as the raw TLB misses, actually vector through the hypervisor first, and then it decides whether it can handle it itself or it's going to revector it down to the supervisor code. So sometimes traps go sideways back down to the supervisor. So here's what a hyper call looks like. Which one did I pick here? Oh, so here's how you stop one of the CPU threads on the Niagara. The outgoing registers on Spark are O0 through O5. For these kind of normal hypercalls, the hypercall type is passed in O5, but O0 through O4 are available for arguments. And then you get a status in O0. And if once you return more information, you get them in O1 to O5. Basically, how this is implemented, which is worthwhile to... Let's go through the example. So first, I put the argument there into O0, I put the hypervisor call type, and that's actually defined to a hex value, which is the hypervisor call number. And at the end, if you got an error, we go to some error else, it happened successfully, and everything's okay. So anyways, so the hypervisor trap table entry for this little guy right here, it has the vector based upon O5. And they do versioning for certain hypercalls. So they can replace parts of the table based upon whether you're using a newer version of the API or not and things of that nature. Now, alongside these hypercalls, there are other hypervisor traps that are used for these kind of things. So things that you that need to be as fast as possible, and you don't want to go through all that crap vectorizing through the call type. They have a direct one, and so for they have one for loading TLB entries, MMU map adder trap. And for these specialized ones, there's no need to use outgoing register 5 for the call type, so you can use it to pass more arguments too. The same kind of handling. You check the return dial. If it's not zero, it's got some kind of error. If you do it, this is really cool in a way because things that you normally wouldn't be validating, normally wouldn't have all kinds of debugging code written for, or not enabled by default, the hypervisor is doing for you. So if you pass a crap PTE into the hypervisor to load, it validates the real address that the PTE maps to because it has to translate it to the physical address before putting it into the actual TLB. It sends you an error. And early on while implementing this, I hit the error a lot. So this was very useful. Stuff that's normally really difficult to debug can be easier because of stuff like that, because the hypervisor is validating all the arguments. So in logical domains, what kind of node types do we have? We have a control node. And logically speaking, when you just take over the whole system, that's a control node too. There really isn't a distinction. In fact, a lot of the LDOM technology now is enabled even if you just boot in plainly into a system, and I'll explain what parts of that kind of stuff are there. And we have to it helps to support that kind of stuff, so we do, even though we don't have full control node support yet. A service node is kind of somewhere between a guest node, which we'll talk about next, and a control node. It doesn't handle the setting up of systems. It doesn't create new guests. It doesn't do things of that nature. But it has access to physical devices, and it can therefore do the physical I/O for other guest nodes and for the control node too. So you can say, okay, this PCI trunk is connected to this system I branched off from the whole system, and it has a couple of virtual disk devices that exports the guests into the control nodes. And then we had the guest node, which is what we're trying to get in the end, which is purely virtualized, no physical access to hardware, nothing like that, only virtual disks, only virtual network, a virtual console, things of this nature. Okay. Every Niagara system, via the hypervisor, provides what's called a machine description. The machine description is not a device tree, although it provides a similar kind of information. It's actually a full directed acyclic graph. It's a full DAG, because it wants to provide both forward and backwards relationships. So basically, there's a hypercall like the ones I showed before that says, give me the whole machine description. Here's my real address of the buffer, and here's how big it is. And it's either going to say, the buffer is not big enough, make it bigger, or it's going to say, OK, I gave it to you. Here it is. It's a real compressed data structure. It's very similar to the data structure that the PowerPC guys pass from their bootloader into the kernel, the compressed open firmware device tree they use. And instead of decompressing it, because there really isn't a nice way to represent the DAG with in-kernel data structures, and it turns out that it's efficient to parse anyways by making some interfaces to make it easier, I just leave it in the state. The reason I do this is this guy right here. It can be dynamically updated as CPUs get popped in and out of the system, or devices get new network devices get created and things of this nature. So instead of having all this in-kernel data structures to protect against, rebuild, regenerate every time one of these a hot plug device event happens, I leave it in this compressed state and just provide interfaces for people to go through it. Another constraint this creates is that anytime a device driver wants to get in and fiddle with the machine description, it has to first gain a reference to the machine description, and any property data or node information it wants, it has to copy it out, put in a local data structure, and then release the reference to the machine description so that when a hot plug device event happens, we can get rid of old ones and just keep the new one. It's interesting to note that the control node makes machine descriptions. So when you boot into the control node, it has a certain amount of resources for the system, and then whatever's left, it can dole out to the other nodes that it wants to create in the system. And so it creates them, it pushes them to the service processor, which actually boots other systems through the hypervisor, and they just sit there. That block of blob of data gets downloaded into the hypervisor for the new systems, and they end up into the supervisor code that wants it. Okay. A logical domain channel, what's this? This is a protocol that they created so that nodes can talk to each other. This is the framework on which all the services on logical domains are implemented. it's really, really, really simple. The hypervisor plays a role in this. Basically, it implements queues that the various nodes register. So they're basically 64-byte blocks. You put your packets into each block, and you can have multiple blocks if you have a multi-segment packet. And then you tell the hypervisor, OK, move the head here. And then it knows that from the tail to the head, it's got packet data. It has to get to the end of the node. It knows how to access real physical memory to copy between the real addresses in the two different nodes. And then the receiver gets a doorbell. He wakes up. He pulls the data out and looks at your packet to see what you had to say to him. It's a pretty simple thing. It has a handshake, which creates a lot of complication because they didn't implement it to the spec in all cases. I'll get into that later. But what this handshake allows is fault tolerance. One thing that's really I find interesting about this implementation is that if the control node barfs and needs to get rebooted, all the guests still keep running. And they get a channel reset event. And if they'll have to block on any I.O. to the disk or whatever that's pending. But once the control node is booted back up cleanly and the virtual devices reappear, they can redo the handshake and just keep going wherever they left off beforehand. But that's not exactly trivial. There is a lot of error handling and funny stuff to deal with, but it does work. So if you crash and it reboots through the hypervisor, what the first thing the hypervisor does is it's an implicit unregister of all the device channels on that node, and that's how the reset occurs. Okay, here's what the packet looks like. A bunch of little 8-bit fields, the type, the subtype, some control bits, and things that are used for fragmentation. For the reliable modes of this protocol, there's a sequence number, and then there's mode. If it's an unreliable, like it's a datagram-like protocol version, it has this sequence number so you can tell what's before what, but it doesn't have an AX or anything like that. The reliable modes have ACK IDs. The reliable modes are used for the network and the disk driver, so you know which ring buffer entries have been processed by the remote end. And I'll get into the details of that later. So I can show you what this looks like. We have it over here. Where is this? So if you can see this guy here, this is I hide this structure inside the LDC protocol implementation. This is ARC Spark 64 kernel LDC.c. And here we have the 8-bit things, the types. So for example, you can have a data that's both providing control information and data bytes, things like that. And here's the bits that implement the handshake. So first you do a version exchange. You make sure that you find a common version that both ends of the LDC channel support and understand. So that there's any changes they had to make that are really not really compatible, you can do things like this and extend the functionality or fix bugs. Then we set up the sequence numbers. This basically gets the sequence numbers going, and then the last one is like, okay, we're ready to talk. And at that point, data happens. And when I say data, there are protocols built on top of this, which we'll see later. So data means do another handshake at the next level and then get the connection going for that. So there's a whole set of layers above this. And here, this is how fragmentation is done. If you need multiple packets to send one chunk of data, you use these bits here. And here's the data area, the unreliable and the reliable one with the ACK ID, and there's a empty 4 bytes there that we should use for something more interesting and useful. Anyways, going back to the slides. Okay, so next thing you're going to ask is, well, in other virtualization technologies, we've got to share memory between nodes to pass I/O data around. How do we do that? And with LDC, LDC has this pseudo PTE here. You store the real address and permission bits and a page size. So if you want to send a packet to another node, you set one of these mappings up. You encode it in a cookie. It's basically an index to this what's called a memory trans table entry. And the other side accesses the data once it gets that cookie in the transfer. So what's cool is you can map it in the CPU. You can also say you can map this in the IO MMU in the remote node. And you can also use what's called a copy operation. The hypervisor provides an LDC copy operation, hypercall, whereas you don't have to worry about setting up TLB entries. You don't have to do all that. It just does a direct real address, physical address copy for you inside it. Now, that's what we use actually in the implementation, even in the I/O devices, because it's the easiest way to handle resets and things like that. There are a lot of really gory issues involved. If, for example, a node goes away, this invalidates or revokes all the map table entries, and then your E1000 controller tries to IO to DMA to that address and it gets a fault. You have to, all this PCI error recovery is going to have to handle that, et cetera, et cetera. It's a mess. It's not the way to implement it on the first approximation, which is what we're talking about here. Okay, so like I said, the protocols are layered. The next layer above for IO devices is the VIO layer. VIO defines protocols for console, network, serial devices, disk, and probably something else that I'm not thinking of right now. So it's the world of devices. There's a handshake. You negotiate a version. You set up the sequence numbers. And additionally, you negotiate device-specific parameters, like what's the MTU for this network device, how big is the block size on this disk, how big is it, et cetera, et cetera. We'll get into that later, the details. Domain services. This is even relevant on a full system node. This is how you do things like CPU hot plug. And then you have to deal with the issue of, since each guest node is like another instance of the open firmware booting up and then booting up into the Linux kernel, you have to store the non-transient environment variables somewhere. So what they do is, they store the a subset of the environment variables on the system service processor that controls the whole system. And it kind of sits along with the machine description. So when you want to change things, you send a message over to domain services to set these variables. And then you'll see them next time you boot up, because it takes them in from the machine description, puts them into the open firmware as it boots, and then you see them in the normal calls as you come into the kernel. You can remotely reboot guests. You can remotely panic them. That's more useful for Solaris because, well, Solaris likes to panic, of course, and because they do system dumps when they panic, so you can diagnose a problem with a hung system by doing a remote panic like that. But anyways, you can remote reboot, hot plug. This is also how you find out that the machine description has been updated and you should recall into the hypervisor to get a new copy and send out add or remove events to all your clients. And we'll get into that later. So this messy little picture is what a system might look like. What I'm showing here with these thick arrows is the machine description transfer and the controlling of the individual systems to the hypervisor. So it uploads the machine description. It says, OK, boot these CPUs, get them into the hypervisor, and then the hypervisor takes control from there. These thin purple lines are meant to be the LDC channels. And as you can see, they're all over the place. I'm showing the physical location, as in the hypervisor has all the queues here, and the SSP and the actual guests and control nodes communicate through here, but actually it would be like, here's one to this one, and that's a logical connection, et cetera, et cetera. So any questions about that? So we're going to look a little more closely and look at the logical view. So the logical view is, okay, here's our first networking device that this guest node has to the control node. Here's the domain services channel. And actually, if this was a full diagram, there would be another domain services channel down to the SSP, because you can do all your domain services work through the control node if it's running, or you can do things like update firmware values directly in the SSP. And actually, that's what the control node does, because it doesn't have something better than the control node to talk to. Okay. And so each system has a machine description and all these LDC channels. So. And one thing that's cool is you don't even have to write a driver for the console. Even a normal console is a bunch of hypervisor calls. It says, read this many bytes, write this many bytes to the console, and it goes straight down to the system service processor, which you can open shells into and look at console logs and things of this nature. So what you do on the guest is that this hypercall actually has an internal LDC channel that the hypervisor maintains and runs itself internally that does all the console stuff. That LDC channel goes to the control node, and there's a console server that runs in the control node that you telnet into, and then you can look at the guests running and things of this nature. Okay, so we're going to talk about the UserLand simulator now. It's great for debugging. It's great for tossing things together really quick. And since the whole of logical domains is a software thing, there's no hardware involved, really, we could emulate the whole thing in user space and just make sure it works. And the other reason I wanted to do it is because I didn't actually want to run Solaris on my machine that badly, so I was trying to defer it as much as possible. But I'm over that now. I'm good. So how did I do it? So all the hypervisor calls actually from C code are just a bunch of function calls. They're defined in the header file. They're actually implemented as assembler stubs like I showed you earlier in that slide. That's exactly what it looks like. So I can just write C implementations that have their own local data structures and implement the LDC queues and blah, 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 blah. One little side note about this, if you actually look on the openspark.net site, they actually publish the whole sources to the hypervisor and all the support tools and things of that nature. And as a lot of you probably know, the whole RTL to Niagara 1 and 2 are up there too if you're into looking at Verilog all day. Anyways, the side effect of that is that often I can look in the hypervisor and A, see how it works to write simulators like this. B, send a bunch of bug reports to the Sun guys and bug fixes. It's pretty cool. But at the time that I wrote this, the hypervisor bits for the logical domains bit wasn't published yet. It's just a timing issue. So I had to kind of figure out from the specification they had given me how this stuff was implemented internally. And figuring out how the doorbells worked with the interrupts generated by the LDC channels and things of this nature, it wasn't straightforward at all. So I did the best that I could. And I made it so that the source code for LDC.c, actually the file I showed you beforehand, can be built right in the userland simulator. Of course, I had to put in things like a kmalloc implementation, all these other grotty details to get it to build, but it worked, and it was pretty trivial to do. It was like raking leaves. Then I did the VIO layer on top, same properties, and then I could write a dummy little disk driver that opened up the channels and talked to a dummy little disk server and just make sure that the handshakes could go correctly, and then we would work from there. But the problem is it was only compatible with itself. It could only talk to itself, and I had totally anticipated that it would completely not work the first time I tried to use it on a real control node, talking to a real control node. So I don't know how well you can see this, but this is what the calls look like in the kernel into the hypervisor things to set up LDC channels. So you configure a transmit queue. The IDs are discovered in the machine description, so every device has an ID, and this is the cookie you use to tell which LDC channel you're dealing with. So networking device has one LDC channel, your first disk device has another. Here's the base real address of your packet queue. It's a ring buffer, and that's how many entries are in the queue. Very simple. You get a HBE OK or some kind of error in return. You can find out if the transmit queue is registered, and I pass in pointers. I know if you read my blog, I hate these kind of interfaces because they really suck. There's no real good definition of what happens to these things in error cases. Anyways, side topic. But with the assembler stubs, this is the easiest way to do it. And you can find out what real address and how many entries are registered. You can get the state. This is something you should do every time you get an interrupt, so you can see, you can read this little state guy here, which says whether the channel's been reset or not while you weren't paying attention, and also tells you the head and tail pointers that are available. So for transmit, you would look at this to see if there's any space left to send more client request packets. And here's how you queue new stuff. You move the tail forward, and it lets you know if it happened correctly or not. You might get an HBE again, which means that the queue's full, and you might spin for a little while, you might defer it, you might wait for the interrupt to say that there's some space again. It's up to you. Now, when I press this button, it's going to look like I'm not changing the slide because they're almost identical at the receive side. But there you go. It's all the same here for setting up the queue and querying it. Same for checking the state. And the only difference is you're setting the head to advance to whatever the tail was after you've consumed all the packets. It's pretty straightforward. Now, the interface I chose was to have a struct LDC channel, but I don't actually define it in the header file. It's the classic opaqueness technique. They won't even know if I change the layout of the structure. They just pass this around when they want to do things. A lot of basic operations. You can allocate a channel. This is how you configure it. Make sure that the ID for the LDC channel really exists, and we can register the queues for it, et cetera, et cetera. And we can free it up later, standard stuff. You can bind, which gets you ready for the handshake. It gets you actually does the physical registering of the receive and transmit channel, so the other end knows you're up. Then you do a connect. That gets the handshake going. And if the other side's ready, he'll do the handshake too. And then when you're done and you want to go away and close down cleanly, you do a disconnect. You can also query the current state of the channel. Perhaps you're polling when you want to respond more quickly to if the channel gets reset or not. You can do that from a timer. Data transfer. You can read and write packets. There's just LDC read, LDC write. You get an error status. It's pretty simple. So if we try to queue up the transmit blocks and the hypervisor says HVE again, we can't translate that to E again, and that's what the caller sees. Reads the same. Then we have a way to set up the mapping tables. I treat it like an IOMMU. It has a table. You index into the table. You allocate chunks within the table. And I think I even share the IOMM entry arena allocator with the real IOMMU code in the PCI and SBUS stuff and on Spark 64. So it was easiest to implement at this way. You can call in to copy bits, to actually call into the hypervisor and copy things around. And so the things that the LDC clients deal with are the cookies, which are just a way to do indexing and referencing these entries in the MTE table. And so you pass in a list of cookies, how many cookies there are, the offset to start at, and the destination address, for example. So that's pretty good. D-rings. Most VIO drivers use what's called a descriptor ring. It's basically an array of things that are behind MTE mapped memory, and we have little helpers for setting them up and releasing them and things of that nature. Another part that I missed when talking about the VIO handshake is that you negotiate parameters that are specific for the device, and then you register D-rings with each other, so you know where to transmit packets and things of this nature. We'll get into that later. The virtual device layer. So I cribbed a lot of code from PowerPC, as I do every other day, it seems, because they always implement things before I have the time to do so. And it turned out that their virtual I.O. devices for P-Series fit the model that I wanted to make for the drivers I was writing. So I pulled that stuff in. What I do is I create a dummy root device because it's not really a root in the machine description. And then I find all the virtual I.O. devices, and I create little VIO dev things. What's cool is that I actually don't create them at the beginning. I just create the dummy root node. And then I register a callback handler with the machine description update machinery. And then when you register for the first time, it's like everything got added. So all the callbacks get called, and that's when the initial instance of the devices get created. So that's kind of cool. Kind of fell out of that. And when devices get removed, we call in. We do a device remove calls, throw all the drivers in there, and they can respond to machine description updates that way through the generic device layer of the Linux kernel, which is kind of nice. I mean, it's all glue code. There's almost really nothing that I actually implemented in the VIO layer. It's pretty cool. I should have said not mimics copies. Okay, there's properties. Every single VIO device has a description of the LDC channel that runs it. So you have a channel ID, what's the receive interrupt, what's the transmit interrupt, and then for networking devices, we have MAC addresses and things of this nature. There's device numbering, so you know which virtual disk you're looking at, for example. Okay, so how do the drivers work? The driver init. And this not only does VIO-specific stuff, it also shields the driver away from a lot of the LDC details. You don't even have to allocate the channel. This guy just handles it for you. You give him all the information he needs to configure the VIO connection, the LDC channel bits, and it tries to set it all up. And if it can't, it gives you an error back. It'll bring the port up for you. It has its own handshake engine, so none of the drivers have to implement this thing over and over again. There's one core VIO handshake layer. And for the device-specific attributes, there's a single callback where the device driver says, okay, here's how you implement the handshake bits for negotiating the attributes of this device, for example. So it's as much generic code as possible. And there's some things for probing link state and sending data and receiving data, standard stuff. I want to harp on this a little bit, actually. So with the handshake engine, one of the problems I ran into was that, so there's a sequence numbering at the VIO level as well, and after you're done with the handshake, the sequence numbers start incrementing. Well, I got the network device working, I got that tested, that worked, and then I was trying to bring up the first disk device, and for some reason it was rejecting my packets. So I talked to my son friends, and they're like, where's the debug a debug module, load this into your Solaris kernel, does LDC VIL, it's going to give you all this debugging, you can see what's dropping your packet. I'm like, okay. So I see in the logs that it doesn't like the sequence number. So I go back and forth, back and forth. And one step earlier in the handshape sequence, just to play around to see what it didn't like, I incremented the sequence number earlier than you're supposed to. All of a sudden, it started working. So I go back to the Sun guy. I'm like, I can't believe this. There's no explanation for it. The sequence numbers are being done differently on disk devices versus NIC devices. Of course, you implemented the same generic piece of code for the handshake, so of course, it must be unexplainable. He said, no, actually, every device driver in Solaris re-implemented the VIO handshake. And, oh, yeah, that's just some slight difference that happened in the disk. I go, yeah, thanks. So that was an interesting little discovery. So what does a driver like the virtual disk or the virtual network driver look like? What's the control flow? You probe the devices in the machine description, and then you start calling driver init. Then you allocate the channel with VIO LDC elope. It has all the details. It takes care of everything for you. And then you set up your transmit the descriptor ring, so you can send packets along, so you can send disk IO requests across, etc., etc. You bring the port up, and then you watch for the handshake to complete so you can start talking to the other end. As you get requests, for example, transmitting a network packet or submitting a block IO, you put them in the D-ring. You send a packet that says, hey, index so-and-so to so-and-so. You should process them because I just put stuff there. The other end acts it, and then it'll give you a response later on. It says, okay, the IO went okay, or no, there was some IO error, or resubmit, or something like that. You can also get data back in your receive ring or through the D-ring itself. For example, you can say, what's the partition table look like on this virtual disk? And you get a blob of data back, for example. So the VIO packets look a lot like the LDC ones. There's data, there's control, there's acts, there's things of this nature. There's a lot of similarity between the levels. Domain services, yes, yet another damn handshake. There's version negotiation. You register a service. You're saying, okay, I can handle the CPU hot plug service. Hook me up. And you can say, I'm shutting down. Let's unregister the CPU hot plug service, et cetera, et cetera. And you enumerate this for every single domain services widget. And here's what's available. There's, like I said, the MD update happens with the domain services. You get a packet that says it's just there's no data attached. It just says read a new machine description. There's shutdown and panic, which I talked about before. There's hot plug, and you can also get CPU status queries from the control node or elsewhere saying what's the status of the CPUs in your node right now. You can also send back all kinds of interesting error messages when you're asked to hot plug in a CPU. So you can say, you asked me to boot CPU 7, but I didn't find it in the machine description. That was just updated, so I can't. It's not there. I don't have the information I need. And you can actually pass text strings back. I don't know what Sun was thinking. I don't even use that. It's stupid. Physical resource inventory. What's this all about? Well, you have an interesting situation where, let's say that you get a correctable cache error. And how this works is the hypervisor handles the error, corrects the ECC, makes everything good again, turns all the caches back on, and then it gives you a descriptor block that says, okay, we got an ECC error, this describes it all. You can report it to the user in the logs or whatever, in the error reporting facility. But the thing is, to be the most useful, you have to have physical addresses and things of this nature. So the physical resource inventory is like the machine description, except it describes everything physically, so you can take these error blobs and give a useful report to the user, like, okay, SIM number 3 had an uncorrectable ECC error. You better go check it out. So that's what that's for. And like I said, firmware holds all the variables that are for booting and things like that. So there's a DS for that. Oh, here's the thing I talked about before, where there's two LDC channels for doing DS. One goes to the service processor, the lights out manager, and one goes to the control node. So if the control node's down, you can still update firmware variables. You can still do very primitive basic operations. The physical resource inventory, the PRI, that looks like exactly like an MDesk. You can parse it the same way. I put everything in a kernel thread for processing DS work because it simplified everything. If you just do it in a kernel thread, then you can sleep while doing CPU hot plug, which you need to do. And so I just do it for everything, because that was the easiest design decision to make. Virtual network devices, what kind of attributes and calls do they have? Well, they have packet transfer mode. You have some choices. You can say, okay, let's just stuff everything in a VIO packet. The whole actual packet we'll put into a VIO data stream with an LDC write. That's not very efficient, but it's very easy to implement. The other one is we can do it through D-rings, which is what I just described before. You put an entry in the descriptor ring, a list of cookies representing the MTE mappings for the data, and then the other side pulls that in with the LDC copy, mapping it into the CPU or IOMMU mappings. The remote MAC address, so you know who's at the other end, the MTU, and there's a way to upload multicast settings. So when we get add a multicast address, we just pass it over with a special call, and then the other side says, okay, I accepted it, or no, I can't, table overflow, or error, not set up correctly, etc. There's another attribute in here I haven't listed, which is the type of link this is. So you treat differently links between guest nodes and links to the control node, because the control node provides connectivity to the outside. So if you got, you set your default route to the VNet device that goes through the control node, and we'll get into that next. So the VNet switch, this is like a bridge device that sits in the control node. So one thing that's neat about this is if you just add support for one VNet device and it can only talk to the control node, you're okay, because if you send packets out to other guest nodes, the control node switch is going to handle it for you. So that's pretty cool. It gives you some fault tolerance. Guests have links directly to each other. They don't go through the switch. And like I said, the attribute tells you whether you've got a switch node capable link or not. Okay, VDC is the virtual disk client. There's tons of wonderful, beautiful acronyms in the LDOM language. Sorry, I haven't expanded them all in every single case to introduce them properly, but there's a packet transfer mode, same thing as the virtual net device, D-ring, or directly in protocol packets. There's a block size, there's a maximum transfer size, and there's bitmask support operations. So they have a whole bunch of operations, like basic stuff like block I/O write, block I/O read, and then there are things like get the partition table, what's the geometry of this device, and you can even do SCSI I/O pass-through to the thing, so you can handle things like CD-ROM and DVD devices as well behind VDC channels, which is pretty cool. There are some cool things about the partitioning stuff and the block size, which I'll get into my crummy things that Sun did with their implementation section later. There's a list. They actually support EFI disk labels as well, and you can pass things in like that. You can change the geometry, whatever. And you can control the write cache as well with another call, and you can implement I/O barriers with this guy right here. Okay, like I said, there's nothing to do for the console on the guest. It goes through the hypervisor anyway on all Niagara node types that you would boot into. The endpoint just lives in the hypervisor. You don't even see it in the guest. The control node does the virtual console concentrator. You give it a list of TCP ports that people can tell net into and what guest node that maps to. Okay. Handshake initiation. So earlier in the user land implementation slides, I said it was only compatible with itself. So I've been working on networking for more than 10 years, and I thought I had a decent idea of how a handshake might go. I thought, okay, the last guy to come up sends the SYN, right? Gets the thing going, or in this case, the version negotiation begin packet, right? So my implementation was send the version, act that. Okay, let's start getting the sequence numbers going, bop, 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 done, and then you're connected. It turns out, these buttheads at Sun, both sides send the SYN, and both sides send the version ACK, and both sides send the ACK again, and then both sides do the whole sequence dance, and then both sides are connected. It's just so ridiculous. So anyways, that was fun to discover. It took me a couple days because I didn't think such madness was possible. I discussed the sequence number handling because they like to write code more than once. Disk label ownership, which is fixed now, but it causes a lot of trouble. So you can export disks in multiple ways from the control node. You can say, okay, here's this physical disk device or slice. Give it to guest node foo index 3 or whatever. So you can pass a physical block device over. Or you can export files as disk. So you create a use DD, no trunk, make a big file, and then you can pass that over as a virtual disk. Well, what the smart VD server would do is, if you didn't have a disk label there, since like apparently Solaris cannot function with a block device if there isn't a label there, it just simply ignores the device completely, won't let you use it. It craps a label onto it, okay? It will also crap a label onto it if it can't, there's something about it it doesn't like. So you can just lose your whole system if, like, you know, some irrelevant bit in a padding area of the disk label is bad. It's just going to crap all over it for you. And the thing is, there were certain fields we didn't implement in the Sun disk label initially under with the Linux tools. And guess what happened? Every time we would reboot, we would reboot the control node, we'd lose the disk label, and I'd have to fix it up. And that wasn't fun to discover. Now they do more smart stuff. The thing was, they expected Solaris at the other end, the first thing to do is ask for the disk label, and it would only write the disk label through the interfaces, so it would always be correct internally within the virtual disk server. They expected people to do it themselves. That's fixed now. there's a couple data structures in the specs they gave me that are defined. So, for example, when you register a D-ring, you give it, supposedly, an array of cookies to the MTE entries that translate the D-ring, so the other side can copy the descriptor ring entries into its local address space. So it looked variable. That means I could have whatever size I needed for the count number of cookies I gave it. Well, it turns out it only handles one, and if you give it more than one cookie, it just ignores the packet and doesn't even ACK you back. So that was fun to discover as well. So all these little things, like, you know, spec says A, implementation does B. Okay. Where do we want to go in the future with this? I'd like to work on the fault tolerance of the guest node stuff first. If the control node crashes, which it will when I implement the Linux implementation of the control node a lot, I want the guest to be sane and keep going when it comes back up. I actually have a version of the LDC module binary under Solaris from a friend of mine in Sun that you can do fault injection. At any point in time, you can just be like, okay, reset the channel now and make sure and see, let's see if everything recovers correctly. It's wonderful. I'll play with that and lose many nights of sleep. There's some things in the VDC driver I don't do. For example, EFI partitions, tables, and the SCSI IO pass-through, because they didn't actually implement it at the time that I was doing it either, so there was no point in adding the code. Now there is. I want to do Linux as a control node, as I mentioned. It's a lot of work because you have this whole configuration infrastructure and user space. There's a whole set of special APIs where there's LDC channels between the control node and the system service processor, so you can do things like, okay, we're making a new control node. Here's its machine description, and here's the firmware variables that they should be initially set to, and you pass these down into the system processor. You also need interfaces to tell the SSP to boot other guests, reset them, et cetera, et cetera. One thing that's really awesome that I like once I got this working is that the guest nodes reboot like this. You type reset all at the firmware prompt, and something that usually takes like a minute or two on a machine with physical devices like that. It's great. So with the Niagara 2 box I have, I can build a kernel and boot into it in like a minute and 40 seconds or something like that from scratch, completely from scratch. It's wonderful. There's a lot of other little userland bits you got to write. You got to write the VCC console daemon. That's not fun. That's super boring code. You just got to trudge through it. And currently, the way that the control node remembers the virtual devices you set, they actually get put into the local machine description of the control node. And it uses Solaris device path names and all kinds of ugly stuff of this nature, so I'm going to figure out how I'm going to handle that. Just use Linux path names. It's all internal to the control node anyway. We don't expect to run a Solaris control node on the same control node that we had used Linux to configure before, et cetera, et cetera. There's tons of things to deal with. Another area that I'm really interested in is bootstrapping guests like really quick, like unpacking images of a default disk installation like as fast as possible instead of going through a whole install on a guest node, things of this nature. Well, if you want to make 24 guests right now, do you want to sit through an install 24 times? No, it doesn't make any sense. So running a lot of the same issues that the Zen folks and the Elgest people are running into. It's like all configuration management, stuff that kernel people don't like to play around with, but it's what the users want. LDOMS is Sun's virtualization technology. Using that in prototyping is great, but it only works with itself. Full guest node support, it works. The only thing that doesn't work is if the control node crashes, you're going to have to reboot your guests. But that's as good as Zen works anyway, so hey, not too bad. I implemented the disk network and DS clients, and it's painful to deal with specification versus implementation. And that's my talk. Are there any questions?
Thanks, Dave. Did you play around with the power management?
Well, that's a good question. Power management on Niagara, there's on Niagara when it doesn't work. There's a call called CPU yield. It's a hypervisor call like the ones I listed on the screen. And it's supposed to put the CPU thread into a state where it doesn't consume any resources on the core. And you would think logically that after a while, you could shut a whole core down if you got things to this point, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't work. But in Niagara 2, it does work. And you don't get significant power savings from it. But what it does do is it allows the other threads on the same sub-core to execute more efficiently. How Niagara normally works is you have a core and you have the virtual CPUs in here, and every cycle it's like, what virtual CPUs are ready to run like that right now? And then you round robin through them every cycle. And so this guy reads memory, he gets off the list. These three guys get the CPU. That guy touches memory, he's off the list. Oh, this guy's memory's ready, he's in the list again. So when you yield, these guys pop out until they get woken up again. So eventually, one guy can get every cycle. Things of this nature. So that's the kind of things we can do now. The whole thing that Sun's trying to sell with these things is that, well, per CPU count and for what the power is inside the machine for certain applications, it is already consuming significantly less power than an equivalent system would be. So maybe they'll do something in the future that's interesting. Any other questions?
VNet versus native, using the device natively, what sort of feeling do you have for the performance difference?
The networking one's easy because that's just, what if you're doing between two guest nodes, it's like a memcopy, right? For I/O, it's such a small amount of it's transactional overhead. I guess you could say it's like having to poke the registers on the device two times instead of once. It's basically what it would amount to, I think. I haven't done any specific measurements, but it's something I would like to do. So it's a good question. What's cool is that you really do get the whole virtual CPU when you're popping them in and out of the systems. So it's kind of significantly different than how Zen handles virtualization of CPU resources, for example. So anything else?
No other questions, then thank you, Dave.